Good morning, Shailen.
Good morning, Jay Barrett. How are you?
I'm good. Yeah, day after an election, you know, I'm usually usually pretty pumped.
It is. Well, a good election season, I think. I guess the big question is, who's ready for the 2020 campaigning to begin?
It began at midnight, I think, somewhere. Probably midnight Maine time.
The ad spots are already being snatched up. The messaging is already being focus grouped. It's all happening.
That's true. There's some speculation this morning on the air that the president might do better against a Democratic House in 2020.
Just having that little bit of a resistance will force the administration perhaps to work with people a little bit instead of just plowing through with whatever, or how does
maybe
the calculus there?
They were thinking that it gives him a legitimate target to criticize instead of them being the opposition and really being ineffective as the opposition. But now they're in the majority in the House, and he will have a target for the next 2 years.
Yeah, that's interesting. Something that I'm curious to see if we're beginning to see any sort of a trend is a first-term president, as those midterms roll along 2 years into that first term, and then it happened with President Obama, it's now happened with President Trump, where the first-chance voters get, because the nation is so evenly divided, Republican, Democrat, red and blue, that the House flips for the midterms, and then you're essentially left with a two-year presidency at that point, because you do have the opposition in the House, and there's not necessarily a lot that can get done if folks don't want to work together.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I was looking at the results as they were coming in last night, and it highlighted the economic situation in America, I thought, very nicely. The Senate, or as they might call it in England, the House of Lords, added three seats, and the House of Commons, swung all the way over to the Democrats pretty handily.
Well, it's interesting, you know, talking about this race on the national level, the seats that were in play. You know, you look to the House, and it was so many seats in suburban areas and urban areas, and then the Senate races were all very rural areas, and so things kind of broke down party lines sort of the way you might expect in that sense, because there is more and more this urban and rural divide, and you see sort of what happens when you've got very few people in a sparsely populated place. They tend to like their representative in Congress, be that a representative or a senator, and yeah. Those rural races are pretty tough.
Well, you know, as that divide that you're talking about grows larger, more people moving into cities, less filling up the cow country in between, or corn.
The hinterlands, as it were.
Yeah. those less populous states, of course, like Alaska, still gets two senators.
That's
just
right.
Like everybody else.
That's right.
And, you know, that's an awful lot of power. You know, we saw it with Uncle Ted, of course.
Mm-hmm.
He was at one point third in line for the presidency.
Right. And those times have changed a little bit, I think. The pork barrel spending, the earmarks, those are not nearly as big a part of the way things are done in Washington, D.C. as they used to be. So that tit for tat, back scratching, you help me out, I'll help you out, that's a lot more difficult to accomplish these days, it seems like.
You know, I think that is an underreported phenomena, the widening of bipartisan, non-bipartisan views, because there's no deal-making for earmarks anymore.
There's no incentive for it. If I'm not going to get my bridge in my home district because you're not going to vote for me because that money simply isn't available, well, then it's just easier to throw mud at you.
Yeah.
There's no benefit.
That's true.
Very interesting. 283-8414 is the number. Of course, we would love to hear you get in on the conversation this morning. Are you hopeful after last night's elections? Are you disappointed? Did your candidates make out with a W? Or what are your thoughts on maybe the statewide ballot initiative? That I'm trying to decide, Jay, if I'm a little bit surprised at the spread on the ballot initiative.
Uh-huh. The big pie chart there.
The big pie chart there on the front page of the Clarion shows pretty, like, two-thirds roughly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, if that drove you to the polls, what did drive you to the polls? Did you vote early? Did you vote on Tuesday? Was the line long? What are your thoughts coming out of the election season of 2018?
Yeah, give us a shout, 283-8414. We'll put you right on the air. You know, we enjoy the company.
We enjoy the company, and if you're getting tired of hearing us, I mean, Jay and I can talk about politics all day, but we want to hear from you as well.
Probably. You know, I was looking, Paul Seaton was defeated by Sarah Vance down in District 31. He, of course, was targeted by the Republican Party for joining the Democrat-led coalition the last 2 years. And Seaton decided not to run in the Republican primary. Instead, he ran here in the general election. Got beat kind of handily, actually.
Yeah,
I'm pretty surprised.
And I had a chance earlier this morning to speak with our colleague down in Homer. That would be KBBI's Aaron Bolton, and he's been glued to that race since before it was even a race, before Sarah Vance even got into the primary earlier this summer. And, yeah, I was able to speak with him a little bit earlier this morning for some insight into that race and kind of what the mood was in Homer and why things shook out the way they shook out.
Should we play that now?
Yeah.
Sarah Vance kind of came into public view in the summer of 2017 as the spokesperson for a political action committee that was pushing for the recall of three Homer City Council members. That recall did fail, and then she went on to actually run for a seat on the council that fall, and she did not get a seat on the council. And then we heard rumblings that she was going to be running for State House leading up to the registration for primaries. And so those in Homer definitely knew her, but she was definitely a new face for a lot of other folks in the district.
And this was such an interesting race because, you know, folks who know Paul Seaton, he'd been a Republican for years and years and years. And then, you know, the switch up with the majority at the House and him switching to be a Democrat. I'm curious. Did that play into this overall election cycle with Seaton switching parties and the shakeup at the House level and all of that?
Well, you know, that question was posed to me last night in terms of if it was a gamble for Seaton to switch his affiliation to nonpartisan. You know, and last night initially I would have said no in terms of anyone that was opposed to Seaton leading up to this election kind of already seemed to, you know, those voters already seemed to have their mind made up. But from a strategic standpoint in the primaries, if he would have remained in the party, he would have squared off against Vance then. And he would also have been running against Anchor Point resident John Cox, who's run a few times.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, that three-way race might have changed things, though I wouldn't have been surprised if the party would have ran Vance as a riding candidate in the general.
You spent a lot of time covering this race and done some great work on it. I'm curious how you might sort of characterize this race down there in District 31. And I'm coming at this sort of from the angle, you know, I heard some of the ads for Sarah Vance in particular that were really pushing that sort of broad kind of a populist conservative message that seems to have found some traction in a lot of different areas of the country. Just curious, you know, what are your thoughts on how the race shaped up? What were some of the influences? Was it that sort of populist message that we've seen in other parts, or were folks just kind of ready for something new?
You know, I didn't hear a whole lot of the commercials that were ran, although I did hear about them. There is a national Republican group that basically creates shell packs around the country to elect Republicans to state races, and they poured, I think, a 7-day report. They poured $34,000 just to in both opposed ads opposing Seaton and supporting Vance. So yeah, it was they dumped quite a bit into it. But in terms of this race, if anyone followed the gubernatorial race, Vance held a very similar platform to Mike Dunleavy, wanted to return to the former PFD formula, wants to repeal SB 91, oppose any income tax. And those are kind of the big three. Seaton referred to them as bumper sticker politics, but they were definitely huge issues for voters in Anchor Point, which is one of the larger precincts. And here in Homer, SB 91 and the PFD were also big issues that we were hearing about from voters, and I think those are the issues that really kind of decided this race. It was kind of a big question if this election was different, and I think it was. You know, I think there were a lot of voters that were just angry with how the legislature was going, and I think, like we've seen in other places in the country, that whether they may have had some love for Seaton, a lot of voters were, you know, they were voting for change, or they were voting party lines, or they were voting on a particular issue.
Aaron Bolton, thanks so much for your time.
Marty, thank you.
Yeah, that was our man in Homer, Aaron Bolton, there kind of breaking down the race between Sarah Vance and Paul Seaton. Of course, Sarah Vance with, I don't know if you'd characterize it as an upset this year, in particular this year. I don't know if you would call that an upset necessarily, especially given that Paul Seaton ran as a Democrat this year.
There's my button. Yeah, he ran as a nonpartisan, though, didn't he? I mean, he was on the Democratic.
He's on the Democratic ticket, yeah.
Ticket, yeah. You know, I don't know if it would be an upset or not, but I do know that the other two House representatives who were in the same position as him that joined the Democratic coalition, Louise Stutes of Kodiak and Gabrielle Ledoux of Anchorage, who used to be the Kodiak representative.
Mm-hmm.
So something down there between Homer and Kodiak in the water, I think. But they both won.
Yeah.
Yeah. Actually, reasonably handily for Louise, and still pretty close for Gabrielle, but still, I mean, it's an assured win.
Are you surprised that Louise Stutes is going back from Kodiak?
No. She's got nothing better to do.
Pretty well liked down there, apparently.
Yeah. I mean, she, her family used to own one of the main bars in downtown.
That's right.
So she's well known. She was on the assembly, and she had a good challenge. I'm trying to find the house number here, but she had a challenge from a young fella, a young local guy whose name I will find. Oh, here we go, Dennis Harris. And he came within 1,000 votes, but it's still 54-33.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It'll be interesting to see if Louise Stutes makes some headlines this next go-around. And I'm talking about, you know, when we talk about ballot measure one, the Stand for Salmon thing, you know, it's not exactly as if salmon habitat protections and that portion of state code had just been simply ignored for years and years and years. Louise Stutes had a bill that a lot of people had spent a lot of time working on prior to ballot measure one being put on the ballot. And I'm curious, you know, if this will potentially spur the legislature into doing something. I mean, that wasn't a necessarily a close race with that ballot measure, as we pointed out, the no's having it by about 2/3 as a percentage anyway. But you do wonder if that's an opening for some legislation, because that's, at least to me, that was really kind of the thrust of that ballot measure, was let's do something. The legislature hasn't done anything yet, so maybe this is the way to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, I just wonder how much political will there is, given the results.
Yeah, there's not exactly a mandate to address that, I would say. And in fact, probably the opposite, given what we're looking at in terms of the makeup for the House and the Senate.
You know, it's It's another perfect example, really, of how big money very easily sways elections in Alaska. If you get on TV, you know, with your $11 million in ads, man, you're probably going to win.
You would think there's, if not direct correlation, then there's at least some trends that suggest that sort of thing. I wonder, I would love to hear from folks, you know, did you feel bombarded by ads this election cycle more than perhaps previous election cycles? If you thought that the ads that you did hear were complimentary, were they misinformative, were they informative? What did you think of those ads? Let's get you in on the conversation this morning, 283-8414.
Yeah, operators are standing by. Actually, it's just us sitting in the control room. So I'm not sure about the future of Gabrielle and Louise going with the majority, being with the majority. They won legitimately in Republican races, or as Republicans. But how welcome will they be?
Yeah, that's. I'm glad that you're here. Watching the House sort of evolve and change over the past few years has been very interesting, and I've had kind of a hard time keeping up with it. You know, who actually is the voting majority? Which side are people on? Because there has been so much back and forth and trying to find a coalition. And I wonder if now no longer having that independent voice from the Walker administration, how much that changes things up when you have a decidedly Republican governor.
You know, it's going to be interesting to see the way the governor and the House and the Senate all work together. You know, because sometimes they don't. You know, Murkowski didn't have a super easy time, and Parnell met with a lot of resistance on a number of things.
Mm-hmm.
But during Parnell's administration, the Senate was a coalition. It was a Republican-led coalition, but it still had all the Democrats in it.
And you also wonder how much, you know, that the campaigning for Mike Dunleavy in particular was so focused on the PFD, and then there was so much mirrored to that for local races, for House and Senate races, folks wanting to protect the PFD. You wonder if that sort of plank in the platform will continue to hold water as we get more and more months removed from people getting their PFD checks and as we get into the legislative session, and how fiscally possible is it to come through with some of those campaign promises? That's going to be really interesting.
You know, I think so too. You know, as far as my take on advertising, I think the message that the PFD should be enshrined and put on a pedestal only to be gazed at lovingly it's not the intent of the guy who invented it, Jay Hammond. When it was being proposed, yes, I'm old enough to remember this, it was rainy day account, you know, and we had a legislature last year that you know, could have done some job bills, but they didn't want to overheat the economy, despite the fact that Alaska's in a recession.
Right.
Which is par for the course with low oil prices.
Yeah, my sort of take on the PFD is a little bit warped because I haven't been here that long. I've applied for several and received them, and that's all great and wonderful. And before we started the show, you're giving the forecast, talking about a little bit of snow on the way. I'm excited because my good oil money went to some new snow tires, and I want to put those to use. I'm tired of driving on dry pavement with my industry funded new snow tires, but. You know, it is different. You know, folks have come to rely on that check a lot, and depending on exactly where you are in the state, it means a lot more to folks in different parts of the state. And I was interested, you know, as I was talking with candidates, and I'm sure you as well, how little we know about specifically what folks spend that on. What specifically is the economic impact? I mean, there's all sorts of anecdotes about it, but to actually nail down what folks are spending that check on every year is pretty tough, and I don't know if there's ever been really much of an effort to track that.
I know that there's a lot spent during the AFN convention because
it happens
right as the check comes out, you know, so several thousand people going to Anchorage right at PFD time. So I'm going to guess snow machines and, well, you know, I used to go in and I'd buy booze when I lived out in the bush.
Well, different folks have different investment strategies, right? That's how you, and that's the other thing is, you know, how much we talk about, you know, Is it responsible use to use that oil money to buy a toy or to go out and, you know, go on a trip or this or that or the other thing? That is money that goes right back into the economy if it's immediately spent. If we're looking for an immediate economic impact, well, you don't get that if it's being saved. But you could also very easily make the argument that that's the more responsible thing to do with that money. So, gee whiz, what to do with all this money?
Yeah. Well, you know, the state of the cash economy out in the bush is, you know, almost non-existent.
Right.
And so the money does help. You're right. I mean, you got a family of four, you know, what is that, $6,000? you know, that'll get you through the winter if you're frugal, I suppose.
Well, and certainly put a big dent in, you know, fuel costs, electricity costs, you know, picking up some gas for the fishing season coming up, all that kind of stuff. That still takes cash.
Yeah, yeah. No PAF around here.
That is correct.
Yeah. Don't forget, you can give us a call. We're at 283-8414. We'd love to hear your voice on the air. If you have any thoughts about the election at any level, from all the way up from State House up to President, you know, through Governor and the Representative, please give us a call, 283-8414. We'll put you right on the air. Promise to treat you right.
We do have some comments from some of the local races that I want to get to a little bit later. But I know, Jay, you've been here throughout the morning hours as folks have been breaking it down. And are you what were you hearing this morning as the analysis was coming in? Was it all about what was the winning message, or what was kind of the theme?
You know, it was very specifically about how Donald Trump was going to spin the results. And he came on at about 8 o'clock and had his press conference. And it was all about, well, exactly that. He was trying to say it was a great victory for Republicans, unprecedented pickup in the Senate, and no, the one thing that they did mention was like when George W. Bush and Obama and probably Clinton as well, mm-hmm. you know, when they lost a majority in their first midterms, you know, they all came out and were like, well, I guess we got to work with the other side now. There's none of that.
No, there's not. And because you, again, you wonder, where's the benefit in that? Because there's, you know, everything's so evenly divided. It's sort of a winner-take-all kind of a thing. You know, if you don't control all three branches, you're just not going to get anything done these days. And I don't know what the answer to that is.
I, you know, empires traditionally fail after a certain amount of time. And, you know, we had a good 230-year run, 40-year run.
It is getting dark this morning in the KDLL studios. The end of democracy. You're hearing about it live. No, I don't. It's going to be very interesting to see, especially at the House level, at the national level. You know, what is that return on investment when it comes to this administration? Because when you talk to Republicans, and I've had the opportunity to speak with Lisa Murkowski since Trump was in office, and you can see when you're talking to certain lawmakers, especially someone who can play as pivotal a role as Lisa Murkowski does in the Senate, that there's a little bit of an aspect of being stuck between a rock and a hard place there, where on the one hand, you don't like the behavior, you don't like the rhetoric, you don't like the divisiveness, but on the other hand, boy, he sure is checking off a lot of items on your agenda. And so how far along are we going to go with this? And it's going to be interesting to see if having the House flipped and is that actually going to serve as a check? I don't know if it will.
Yeah. And as far as Lisa Murkowski's poll in the Senate, adding three more seats is unempowered her for holding out now.
It really has. Yeah, there's that we talked earlier about the power that a single senator can have, but that changes dramatically as the numbers change, as the majorities change. And one senator who had so much power to stop or let things go through just a few months ago, now there's three extra Republican votes on the Senate, so we're not holding out for you anymore, Lisa. That's going to be interesting to see how that plays out. Speaking of senators, too, just a note, Senator Dan Sullivan will be in town tomorrow, I believe, speaking with the Chamber of Commerce in Soldotna. So there's a little note if you'd like to get out and say hello to one of our senators.
On a Thursday?
I believe so.
Oh, okay.
Usually they're on Wednesday, but right. Senators are busy folks. So
oh, yeah.
Whenever you can get them.
You know, I have never met him. Which is really weird. He would come down to Kodiak and campaign, and every time he was there, my reporter would interview him because he was there in the afternoon, mm-hmm. or We wouldn't find out he was in town until he was leaving.
Right. He's he keeps a relatively low profile, I think, relative to some past senators. I know when Mark Begich was senator, he was still in office when I first moved up here. And he came, I wouldn't say campaigned heavily, but he made fairly regular stops around. And I had a couple of opportunities to interview him. And, of course, Lisa Murkowski has been at it now for a while. And she has her sort of regular round of stops that she makes on a relatively regular basis. You get a chance to speak with these folks. But Dan Sullivan, not so much.
Yeah. Actually, you know, I take it back. I met him. They held a Senate hearing on the Magnuson-Stevens reauthorization last winter out at the college. I met him there.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I forgot about that.
Yeah. Our phone number, 283-8414. You know, I'm assuming we're on the air. You know, I didn't press all the right buttons, but yeah, we are. Just wanted to make sure that folks out there were hearing us. And if you'd like to give us a call, 283-8414. We promise not to ask you if you'd like to pledge if
yeah,
you call.
It's not one of those shows.
Yeah.
I'll tell you, I am really interested if folks do want to take a couple minutes and chime in. I am really quite curious about what got people out to the polls. Was there a specific candidate, a specific race, or was it perhaps the ballot initiative? Was it the national sort of fervor? Was all of that playing into it? Because this, for a midterm election, boy, there sure was a lot of attention paid to this, and I think a lot of heartburn kind of on both sides.
Yes, that button and that button. Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, I mean, as far as getting out to vote, it's just our civic duty, you know, it's what we should be doing. You know, as far as the local issues, you know, I think the dividend is one that that sticks with people and has made a difference this year. You know, even you look at Michiki, he was running unopposed, theoretically, and he only came out with 60% of the vote. You compare that with a guy like Gary Knopp. He was running opposed, and he got 95% of the vote. And, you know, I think the past record shows that people were kind of displeased with how he's been doing down there in Juneau. And, you know, that's a pretty big issue that I hope he listens and takes to heart. He won, but there was a lot of people who voiced their opinion, and I think the dividend was a big part of that, as far as how he fell in line with the Walker administration. And you know, he needs to look at that going forward as to where people's views are on it, and because the dividend means a lot to folks in Alaska, and it means more to the folks that have less. And you know, really, it's a pretty important thing that we keep in balance in our state government. It's a great thing that Jay Hammond put together, and then all the people that worked hard at that point in time to balance the hunger for spending with that oil revenue that we get in the state. So,
all right, and that's just going to go up when we get the natural gas. So.
Yeah. Whenever that happens. And, you know, interesting point on that, Russia earlier this year just started shipping LNG from the Yamal field on a icebreaker LNG tankers earlier this year. So new technology and new ways to develop, it's happening. One of these days, maybe we'll get on the eight ball and make something happen ourselves here in Alaska.
Yep. Hopefully. I'm not holding my breath, you know, since we're still a resource extraction colony of so many others.
That's right. It's all about the mighty dollar.
Hey, thanks for calling. Anything else?
All right. No, just have a good day and thanks for the show.
You bet. Thanks for calling.
All right. Goodbye.
That's an interesting kind of a point to bring up. Speaking about natural gas, what I felt was kind of not talked about a whole lot during this election cycle was the AK LNG project. I mean, this is a 50 plus billion-dollar project promising thousands and thousands of jobs during construction would really be a boon to the economy and really help folks out across the state in terms of energy costs. And you would think that something like that would be front and center on a statewide politician's plate to run for, but here we were talking about the PFD instead. And I don't know exactly why that is, and I'm really going to be curious to see, you know, Governor Bill Walker was a huge proponent of the natural gas line, huge proponent of it. And, you know, will the governor's office continue to show that same support to that project under a Mike Dunleavy administration? It's right. Time will tell.
Yeah. Yeah. It's that's going to be an interesting thought. Maybe it's just the election was driven, the campaign was driven by PFDs because that's, you know, where it affects people most immediately.
Yes.
We Alaskans and Americans aren't always the best at planning for the future. Delaying satisfaction now for a bigger reward later. You know, like the kids with the marshmallows, that experiment.
Uh-huh.
We're like the ADD kid who can't resist taking the marshmallow.
That is a very interesting part of human nature that we must deal with at the intersection of politics sometimes, is what decisions are we making now, and will we still be happy with them a few years from now? That's, nobody has a magic eight ball, unfortunately.
Yeah, or political will to, stand out from the crowd. And there was a description of a representative once I heard, it's like, he's a lot like a nail. I go, what, a nail? He goes, he knows that the nail that sticks out gets hammered down.
Squeaky wheel gets the grease, right?
Yeah.
That's it.
So.
Well, thanks for that call. 283-8414 is the number if you would like to jump in on the conversation. Again, very curious to hear what your thoughts are in terms of why you voted or why you were paying attention this election season, what your thoughts are as far as what was the most important issue this season. Was it fish? Was it the PFD? It seems like the PFD really kind of won the day in terms of what was the big issue. I'm kind of surprised. For as much money as the ballot proposition won, the Stand for Salmon Initiative, for as much attention as that claimed, it really kind of towards the end of the campaign, I didn't feel like that was the major issue. And certainly when you talked about the gubernatorial race, I don't feel like that was the big issue at all. The big issue there was the PFD.
Yeah, you know, and I don't watch network TV, so I don't know what kind of ads were happening here in the last week. But the Stand for Salmon just. Before the primary, it was like it wasn't even an issue. You know, I remember people talking more about it last winter when the petitions were out to get it on the ballot,
right,
in the first
place. And then there was the court case, and there was some language removed. Yeah, it seemed like it was a bigger issue maybe even before the primaries. I know, and that's not to disparage any of the folks that were working on that issue on either side, because we saw the signs, and there were a lot of folks out trying to holler for votes either way yesterday. But at the end of the day, there's not that's not a check at your door. That ballot measure did not represent a check in the mail.
No, that's true. Hopefully it will be one of the things that the legislature decides to address.
It looks like there's an opening there. I don't know that the way that vote shook out with a two-thirds majority saying voting no on that's much of a mandate for legislative action, but we'll see.
Hi, you're on the air.
Oh, thank you. I like the discussion this morning.
Oh, thanks.
I was curious to see what kind of thought you had given to the local races. I haven't been here but for 3 years, but I do find that family connections and a very small community makes for some long-term memories. And I didn't really delve too much into Paul Seaton's history. But I did watch to see what kind of reactions the local folks had to, number one, his switching parties, and number two, some deep-seated anger over what had been happening down in Homer. And the other thing that I somebody was asking, you know, what brought the voters out. I vote, period. And I think, you know, people should do that. But the one thing that struck me during the whole debate on the Proposition 1 ballot, you know, the Stand for Salmon ballot, was how little actual in-depth analysis we voters got in advance of that. The positions that were advertised were so extreme. It was drawn in such simplistic terms. And to a certain degree, I can understand that. But what made me come out and vote on that issue was my own analysis of, number one, what systems do we have in place for protecting the environment? And is that system flexible enough or not to handle the concerns that the proponents of the ballot measure were pursuing, versus what unintended consequences would we have seen if the ballot measure had passed?
Ah, yes. You know, I agree with you. I don't think there was enough, you know, it was all bumper sticker campaigns on that thing. There was nobody really talking about the inner workings of it other than guess it does, no it doesn't kind of arguments.
Right. The best program that I heard on the whole thing was when it was either you two or one of you interviewed Andy Mack. I guess what you call the prior administration now, and he went through the constitutional provisions on natural resources in this state.
Yeah, that was, I had that conversation with Andy Mack, which we aired during our fall membership drive, and it was really enlightening to speak with, again, Andy Mack, of course, the commissioner of the Department of Natural Resources. And that day what we were speaking about specifically was the Chewitna coal mine on the west side of Cook Inlet, but so many of those water rights questions are sort of tied into ballot measure one. And what is the scope and purview of the Department of Natural Resources? And really more importantly, and you pointed this out, what can they handle? How flexible can they be? What are they prepared to do? And I think that really was the major question in terms of why ballot measure one was put on the table to begin with, was this idea that as a state that, as you pointed out, Jay, is still exporting resources as a means of sort of survival, how do you do that in a way that keeps everything sort of sustainable, or at least as much as you can for as long as you can? And those are big questions that are going to have to be dealt with. And speaking with Commissioner Mack, it was pretty clear to me that even at that level, he's not entirely sure that department does have all the resources that it needs to properly vet each and every project that comes down the pike. So, yeah, very interesting to talk to Commissioner Mack about this. And also on the ballot measure one, I think one of the reasons why maybe there wasn't quite so much in-depth analysis and why it was boiled down to such simplistic terms is, despite the language on the ballot measure, there would still have been a lot of work to do at the legislative level to actually get that law on the books and get those rules written out and figure out how this thing's going to shake down. There was still, you know, a year plus of work to do on it. And so what the specifics are, it's tough to talk about because those had yet to be fleshed out on a pretty broad level.
Yeah,
exactly. And the other question I had when I was looking at the initial election results last night was, assuming that there is a strong Republican showing in this state, which is kind of unsurprising, does that presage any change or any shift in the ability to get anything done down at our state legislature?
Might smooth the way a little bit, I think.
It depends, I suppose, on what you would consider getting things done and what you would consider good progress. But I think with a decidedly Republican governor and the way things have shaken out at the House level and the Senate level, it would appear to me, at least on the face, that there are going to be some things done. Precisely what, we're yet to see, but I would see some more room perhaps for agreement on issues than there was with the previous administration and legislature.
Yeah, and don't forget that.
I'm struggling to hold on to a thread of hope. I mean, it seems to me that too many of our state representatives, and I guess this goes to the national legislators as well, just kind of leave their common sense at the door.
Well, you know, when they start getting lobbied by different people, you know, industry doesn't often have the same goals as regular people. So, well, once they get some power, you know, they become really popular.
That is how that works.
Anyhow, thanks for your discussion this morning.
You bet. Thanks for calling.
Thanks for that call.
Bye-bye.
I wanted to go back to the first caller we had. He was speaking about the race for Senate District O, and that was interesting in that it was technically on the ballot an unopposed race. Senator Michicki narrowly winning the primary back in August, but his opponent Ron Gillum, of course, launching a fairly well-publicized write-in campaign, and then Willow King there at the end also launching a write-in campaign. And as I was looking at the numbers earlier today, the write-in numbers did show a little bit of a boost overnight. Of course, Michicki won that race fairly handily, but still 4,000 plus write-in votes between the other two candidates. I don't know exactly how that broke down between Ron Gillum, Willow King, and perhaps whomever else. But
Mickey Mouse
and Mickey Mouse always a popular candidate, I'm sure.
No matter where you go in America.
And couldn't get in touch with Senator Michicki late last night, but did have the opportunity to speak with him late last week as we were getting, you know, down to the home stretch of the election. And he did talk a little bit about what he learned coming out of that primary, out of that incredibly close primary race, where for a minute there, I know that he was juggling, am I going to be the write-in candidate for the general election? And we have a little bit of tape of Senator Michicki addressing that.
Okay. And let's see, if you're calling right now, we will be right back with you. Please stand by.
What I learned from the primary and from this election cycle is I have to find a way to sit down with those constituents that the public meetings aren't working, the newsletters aren't working. How do I get them to come up to me and say, Michicki, I'm mad, and this is why, and have that conversation in small groups or with individuals where we can talk about those issues, because there's clearly a group of people that are unhappy with my performance. And I think if we can have those conversations, we can sort of understand each other, how things are in Juneau versus the impacts at home, and how we can find solutions that make them feel more represented, right? And it's obviously, I don't know that it's on the right. I don't think it's on the right. I think there's a group of folks on sort of two camps that I'm going to reach out to. I represent everyone in District O, and it doesn't matter if they're the furthest left or the furthest right or right smack dab in the middle. I want to hear from them and work that out.
That was Senator Michicki speaking just very briefly or very shortly before the election, and kind of talking about what he saw as sort of the dynamics in the district where he's running and some of the various challenges that he's getting from both sides. Again, trying to play that center card a little bit, and it was a bit of a tough road to hoe, especially during the primaries.
Yeah, you know, I did not look up, but it would be interesting to find out what his numbers were 4 years ago.
We should look that up.
Yeah. Well, perhaps we'll do that while we take a call. No? Please call back.
Always give us a try back, 283-8414.
Yeah. Let's see. You know, and Mr. Gillum's campaign was, the main thing I noticed about his campaign is that he had a lot of signs before the primary,
mm-hmm.
like a whole bunch of signs. And I saw one small sign between the primary and the general election.
The sign fiasco, I guess, for lack of a better term, especially for that race in Senate District O, was quite interesting, because I know Senator Michicki was posting on Facebook fairly regularly about his signs being knocked over or disappearing from a lawn, and as you pointed out, it was an issue that you could observe with Ron Gillum. So maybe there's less and less of an appetite for signs in general, and we'll just see fewer of them. Maybe that's the key message out of 2018.
But maybe the primary election wasn't really a clampdown, but they actually did some enforcement, DOT, on some signs. So, you know, hopefully we can get back to the 1998 resolution.
Well, you did a story about that, right? A
couple of them, yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, honestly, when I'm out driving in the lower 48, I love billboards along the side. It's like, oh, interesting. Oh, look, free steak.
Wow. The ones that I remember in Iowa were always, they would be stretched out over the course of like a mile along the road, and they would have a nice little campaign slogan as you went sign by sign, phrase by phrase.
But, oh, like the Barbasol?
That's right.
Yeah. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, this is Jeff Lominick. How are you guys doing?
Hey, Jeff.
Good morning, Jeff.
Doing well. How are you?
Not too bad. I kind of had a different question. It has to do with Shailen and the production he was in, Lame Ducks and Dark Horses. I don't know if you did. Did you get to see that? Or?
No, I don't know what we're talking about here.
This is Jeff's referring to the political spoof that Triumvirate Theater produces during right. election years every couple of years. Oh, no. What am I stepping into here, Jeff?
Actually, there was a joke in there at their expense, but that's not what I'm here to ask about.
I had several nonpartisan roles in Lame Ducks and Dark Horses.
Actually, the question I had then was for Shailen, if Jay wasn't able to see it, but obviously I went to the rehearsal to write a story for the paper, and then I went to the opening night, and I was surprised. It seemed like a lot of people were kind of timid about laughing, and That seems to be one of our great kind of political traditions, is to be able to kind of laugh at each other. I was wondering if that was an exception or if it got better, because I found that kind of disturbing. I think in the end we should all be able to kind of have fun and laugh at each other. So was that an exception, or is that something that they continued throughout the rest of the three shows?
That's a great observation, and thank you very much for coming out to the show. I would say that was an exception, and I don't know why that was. I'm not sure exactly what the makeup was of the audience the first night. Of course, we do a pair of shows 2 weekends in a row, and I think maybe on some level we just get a little bit better at reading the crowd and getting the jokes out a little bit better, and that helps. But no, you were absolutely right. As the show progressed, the jokes seem to fall a little bit more evenly across the entire crowd. I don't know. That's an interesting observation. And I don't know if it has to do with just the charged political times that we're in, that folks are a little bit hesitant to really let go in a setting like that, or what the story was. But I thought we did a pretty good job of making jokes about everyone across the board. So I don't know.
Yeah, that's kind of where I was coming from with that question, was that the times, the political times we are in, are so charged, and it does just seem to be maybe a disturbing signal of it, but I'm glad to hear it got better.
It did get better, and I will, a little peek behind the curtain, I will tell you that some of the material, even before we got it on stage, in front of an audience, we kind of reworked a little bit, and a lot of it based very much on sort of national discussions about different things. I won't get too deeply into it, into what our joke editing was, but there were definitely some conversations and some concerns about, you know, what is the national conversation that we're having about this or that, and how does it sort of filter down to the local level, and is that too much? Is it not enough? How do we kind of make this work for our friends and neighbors here in our own backyard? But as always, that's a really fun show to put on, and it's really, as you mentioned, Jeff, it's very much an opportunity to get folks together from every political stripe to just kind of take a deep breath and relax a little bit and laugh at what can sometimes be the absurdity of politics and what we all have to sort of watch and listen to and see happen around us. And it did get better as we went along, and I hope that everyone who came out had a great time. And thanks again for you coming out, Jeff.
No problem. Maybe next time we can get Dave Barrett out there.
Next time, we'll work on it.
You bet. Hey, thanks, Jeff.
All right, thanks. Have a good one.
Did you have another question?
No, I'm good. Thanks.
All right. All right, take care. Jeff Ilminiak of the Prince of Clarion, the sports desk.
Wanted to also, gosh, it's we're getting down to kind of the last little bit of the hour here. Wanted to also throw some attention to the race in House District 29. That was an interesting one. We had the independent candidate Sean Butler and the Republican candidate Ben Carpenter in the general election. And you you interviewed Ben for this race. And mm-hmm. and did you interview him before the after the primary?
Yes, it was after the primary.
Yeah. And that was really interesting, too, because Wayne Ogle, of course, the current borough assembly president, was running for that spot out in Nikiski. And I think the early money was on Wayne Ogle in the primary. I think that was probably one of the bigger surprises of the overall election season.
I wonder if people thought he was too mainstream, because Carpenter was campaigning on, he's a true conservative voice.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know.
You know, that was very much his message. And again, had an opportunity to speak with him. We can go to this tape. I spoke with him late last night. He was at home watching the returns come in. At the time when we spoke, there were still a couple of precincts left to report, but it was more or less in the bag by that point. And we did talk a little bit about sort of what he thought worked in terms of his messaging, and especially in terms of against an independent candidate who tried to cover all of the bases a little bit. So, here's a little bit of my conversation last night with Ben Carpenter, winner in House District 29.
Well, I am at home with my family. That is the most important place I could be tonight. I'm encouraged by the numbers. They look good. I think we're still waiting for three precincts to report, and it's probably a big hurdle to overcome for the opponent, but the last election I learned to not count my chicks before they hatch, so I think it's good. It's good numbers and a solid lead, so everything looks good. I'm not entirely sure that there's any specific message other than this is a very conservative district. The people by and large are limited government, low tax type people, and that was a consistent message that I had. My opponent was not necessarily that consistent, or not doesn't have the same message. So I just think it was the right message for the right crowd. Yeah, I'm concerned about the REVAC and Sloan numbers. I was hopeful that they would be a little bit more positive. Those are two candidates that I was hoping to see win. I'm happy to see Sarah Vance is doing well. Those are a few of the races that I was looking at. Prop 1 looks like it's going to go down, hopefully, and those are good. Dunleavy's doing well so far, although not a large number of precincts reporting in, but his numbers are looking good too.
Yeah, it looked like all those followed through.
All those followed through. That speaks to what we were talking about earlier. Will this legislature be productive in any way? And with the majorities the way they are, and the governorship the way it is, again, depending on what your definition of progress and success is, certainly some things probably going to get done.
Yeah. I'd say I looked up the 2014 numbers for Senator Mushicki, 5,704 votes. Excuse me. And his independent challenger, Eric Trider.
Yep.
I had 1,587, so about a 4,000 vote difference.
And Mushicki picking up some more votes this time around. So, yeah. I wonder if that speaks to just higher turnout in general, or if it was the sort of the dynamics of that particular campaign where it was just his name on the ballot and a lot of folks not too concerned about the write-in.
Yeah. But there seems to be a pretty consistent 4,000 people who would rather vote for somebody else.
That's very true.
Last time and this time as well.
We just heard. Here's another call coming in.
All right, let's take that real quick. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, it's Caitlin.
Hi, Caitlin. Good morning, Caitlin.
Good morning. Glad you're taking this call. Thank you.
You bet. So you're calling about the salmon initiative?
Yeah. We were disappointed. Pointed, of course, that the initiative didn't pass, but we were really happy for the opportunity to work on something like this that elevates the conversation about, how we protect salmon habitat and what we do up here in Alaska to make sure that, we don't make the same mistakes as the places in the lower 48 did that don't have salmon anymore. So I don't know. Looking forward, there's lots to talk about how we do things right up here.
Are you hopeful, Caitlin, that having this issue on the ballot would spur some legislative action coming up in the next session?
Yeah, I'm very hopeful. I mean, I think that's sort of one of the reasons that this was on the ballot as a citizens' initiative. After all, you know, it's been years and years that nothing's really happened in the legislature. So I think that this has brought things to the table. I think there's a lot of people who agree that things need to change when it comes to transparency for permitting, you know, decisions being made based on science-based standards and not politics, you know, better tailings pond technology. You know, there's a lot of things I think that people agree on across the board that are changes we need to make. And this issue became very divisive and political. But I think that there's now a lot more conversations about the specifics of what needs to change. So I'm very hopeful that we can make some, you know, forward progress in the next session and in the next years. And we know that this is going to be lifetimes of conversations about how we do things right. And hopefully we'll just, you know, get better and better.
Very good. Well, Caitlin, thanks so much for calling in this morning. And I know you're very involved in this election. Thanks so much for all the work you put into that.
Yeah. Thank you for coverage. And thanks to all the volunteers who worked and everything. And I think we had some of the best turnout this year, too. So thanks to everybody who voted. It's good to be a part of a system like this, where people are engaged.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much again.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, that must have been Kenai River Center must have been a dreary place last night.
Perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, just the sheer size of the results for ballot measure one, I was surprised by that. I thought if anything, it would be super close with yes winning.
I would be super interested to see some real studying done into sort of a post-mortem and see all those dollars, what kind of effect did they have? If that really was the key, was the money that they got pushed into that particular issue of the campaign.
I thought they were going to win largely on their slogan alone, stand for salmon. I mean, who doesn't want to stand for salmon?
But who doesn't want to stand for Alaska?
That's true. Stand for Alaska, vote no.
Yeah.
Okay.
kind of an interesting calculation there.
Yeah. Well, let's see. We are almost out of time. We got about a minute to go here. Any last thoughts?
The only thoughts that I would have, I guess, sort of mirroring, echoing what we heard from Ben Carpenter a few moments ago, I wouldn't say that we necessarily learned a whole lot about our districts here on the Central Kenai Peninsula and a little bit further south. I think kind of reinforcing the notion that this is overall relatively a conservative area, and those are the folks that they want to have in Juneau representing them, and that's what they got.
I think you're right. 100%, as well as Mr. Carpenter as well. I have no thoughts because I'm out of time. You've been listening to the Kenai Conversation. Shaylin Cochran and myself, Jay Barrett.